There's only three of you, sir. You, Dr. George, and Miss Mabilet.
Oh.
And Honorable de Villiers.
Oh, yes. Sorry. I keep on forgetting him. Yes. And Mr. de Villiers.
Okay. So we're running short of two.
Yes.
Members.
Chairperson, we can start.
Who else has joined?
Honorable Buteles and Honorable Shivam.
Okay. Inkosi Buteles.
Honorable Chair, good morning and colleagues.
Kunjani shenge?
Ah, siyaphila sihlala njani?
Angikubonanga lapha when you were inaugurating the king. Where were you?
Oh, I was there. I wouldn't dare not to go.
Oh, well, you were delinquent. You disappeared.
I was there.
There was no way that you couldn't be there.
Oh, I couldn't dare not to go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, Shang. Good to hear from you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Sure, sure, Shang. Okay. Let's start, honorable members. The meeting is officially open. And let me welcome all members of the committee. Welcome officials from National Treasury, led by Comrade Momo. And FIC present here, and then also all the parliamentary officials from different divisions who are providing support to this committee. Let me welcome all the stakeholders who are in attendance and the media. You are all welcome. Roll call and apologies.
We didn't receive any apologies, sir.
No apologies.
Yes.
Honorable Shivambo is raising his hand.
No, thank you very much, Chair. I just wanted to indicate that at 10 o'clock, I'll be joining the Chief Whip's Forum. But I wanted to bring to your attention that the South African Reserve Bank has still not responded to the questions that we have sent to them. And I thought that there was an agreement that they must respond as soon as possible, but they have not done so. It's 7 days later now, and there are no responses from the governor of the Reserve Bank on an issue which was raised in this committee. Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Shivambo. We'll make a follow-up with them. Thanks. Let's proceed. Mr. Momo Niat and FIC, who's representing FIC?
Good morning, myself, Peter Smith.
Yeah, I think.
It's Peter Smith. We'll start between Momo
Chair, thank you very much, Honorable Chair and Honorable colleagues. Honorable members and colleagues.
You will be joining us in the next 2 years when you go on pension. come and retire here.
I don't think so, Chair. Thank you for this opportunity, Chair. So we just needed to be guided. As you know, the schedules were presented and the committee has had hearings. We've got just a few slides just to respond to the comments that were received for members to consider. And so if you may proceed with the presentation, Chair, if that's okay with honorable members, we'll proceed. Okay. Okay, let's get to the first slide. So, Chair, we've got a big team from Treasury and the FIC represented here to respond to any queries that members may have and to comment on the comments that we've received. Next slide, please. So, Chair, I think the comments that we've had sort of generally, some related to wording on certain items. There were many, I think, who requested that they be excluded. Often they didn't have a problem with the legislation, but they wanted to be excluded. And many requested clarity and guidance. I guess on part of it is just how the system would work. I'm going to ask Peter Smith to come in just to go through the comments. So the 11 entities that commented. Peter, do you want to come over and just raise the 3 points and let's just go through all of the comments. And maybe you can also just deal with the approach that we take that just within each sector, because honorable members, there were concerns. Obviously, if you look at customer due diligence requirements being put, let's say there were some members from the retail sector. We wanted to clarify some of it is in their capacity as being credit providers. And just to point out that even within a sector, there's a risk-based approach. And within the risk-based approach, the type of reporting that's required is generally, we hope, in line with what they would do. So if they are going to process a credit application, they would know your name, your ID number, et cetera. It's not necessarily as onerous as onboarding when a bank takes on a customer, but I'll ask Peter Smith just to come in and guide us. Over to you, Peter.
Thank you very much. Good morning, members and colleagues. And Mama and the colleagues from Treasury will also jump in during the presentation where they want to add. But we'll touch on sort of in a summarized fashion on the themes that came out from the comments. There is also a written document that's a table that's sort of a comment by comment response in more detail to each of the comments that we've made available for the committee
recording in progress
to consider. So as Mama had indicated, by our count, we've seen 11 submissions made to the committee in response to the publication of the schedules for and the invitation for comments. Of those, 3 did not really deal with the issues of commenting on the scope of the FIC Act. One comment was requesting guidance from the FIC, and I think it's to the point that Momo made just now that I'll touch on in a slide or two. One of the comments was on the scope of supervision. In other words, proposing that the JSE should be one of the supervisors, and we'll deal with that comment just now. And then there were one comment supporting the implementation of the changes without any further comments on the entities that commented on Schedule 1 and the scope of the, so we can move to the next slide, please. Of the entities that commented on the scope of the FIC Act, and half of those have also commented in the previous process where the minister published these proposed amendments for comments. And they've provided their views on those amendments, and those views are very similar to what they've provided in this process. The comments focus mainly on four of the proposed categories. Item two, that will add in company service providers along with trust service providers that are already covered by the FIC Act. Item eight, that covers life insurers. Item 11, that covers or will bring in credit providers under the scope of the FIC Act. And item 20, that will bring in high-value goods dealers in the scope of the FIC Act. Of the comments that were made in respect of these items, even the institutions that did not comment before, the comments that they did make now were very similar to comments that were also received during the minister's consultation process. So the position, these matters have been well considered in the proposals that were finalized for the minister to advise the minister on the amendments that he then intends to make now and that are currently before the committee in this process. So we can move to the next slide. We'll deal with these responses, as I've said, in a summary fashion. But to pick up on the point that Mohamed makes in the beginning, it's important to keep in mind that the framework of the FIC Act requires institutions. It's not an option. It requires institutions to apply a risk-based approach. It's inherent in the fabric of the FIC Act that institutions must understand the risk that they face for being their products or their services being exploited by their customers to launder money or to finance terrorism. And they need to structure the level and the intensity of their compliance in accordance with their understanding of that risk. That inherently means that there cannot be a one-size-fits-all approach. In the manner in which institutions comply with the FIC Act. And compliance in a law firm, for instance, would look very different from compliance in a bank. And that, again, in turn, would look very different from compliance in a high-value goods dealer. Because the exposure to money laundering would depend on the nature of the business. A high-value goods dealer is buying and selling items. A bank provides a much wider range of services, and therefore they would have to have a much wider coverage of their compliance with the FIC Act within the business. So the nature of the business determines to a very, very large extent how the business would comply with the FIC Act, what it needs to do, and how it would approach protecting itself from being exploited by its customers who have ill intent in mind. The mitigation of risk is very much a mechanism for the institution to shield itself from the money laundering that's being carried out by its institution, by its customers. This also means that supervision of compliance follows the same approach. And we'll touch on the plans and the envisaged rollout of these amendments sort of in the last few slides of this presentation. So we can move to the next slide. So I'm going to briefly touch on the comments that were received on those four items, the themes in those comments, and the advice from the FIC and the colleagues in the Treasury for the committee to consider in respect of these comments. For the trust and company service providers, the comments were that the text in the amendment appears to be wider than the scope of the FATF standards, and that the new provisions, especially in respect of company service providers, would place a burden on small practitioners, small firms, accountants and lawyers, etc., that provide this service to their customers, and that there's a potential overlap in the responsibility for supervision of the various entities because they sit in different professions and are regulated differently depending on the profession where the service provider operates. So our response firstly is that we've aligned the crafting of this item as closely as possible to the FATF standard, but we cannot simply directly translate or copy and paste the terminology used in the FATF standard into the South African law because it would not fit within the drafting of our legislation. It has to make sure align also with the way in which the Trust Property Control Act is drafted or the Companies Act is drafted and use the concepts that are familiar in our law when we refer to these items in the schedule in the FIC Act. So it's not a direct translation or direct copy and paste of the FATF standard, but in our view, the text does align with the FATF standard and covers the scope that we believe should be covered for South Africa to ensure that entities that operate in the South African system are adequately included in the scope of the FIC Act. We can move to the next slide. It is important also to keep in mind, and this has been borne out in practice all around the world, not just in South Africa, that the misuse of companies and trusts as vehicles to launder money, to create a front for people to operate at arm's length with financial institutions without being known by the financial institution is a very common typology that we see in money laundering schemes, especially, and to some extent also in terror financing schemes. And therefore, it is important that we provide adequate coverage for this category of service providers. We don't believe there's a potential overlap in supervision because these amendments that are currently before the committee also include amendments to the schedules that determine the supervisory bodies for the different categories of accountable institutions. And the result of these would be that the supervisors, such as the FIC, the FSCA, and the Prudential Authority, would be able to structure the supervision through memoranda of understanding that we already have in place to ensure that we divide the responsibility for supervision in accordance with the mandate areas of the different institutions. For instance, there's currently also such an MOU in place between the FIC and the Legal Practice Council in respect of legal practitioners, where the agreement between the two institutions is for the FIC to oversee compliance with the FIC Act for the legal profession. So there's ample scope for the supervisors to have a common understanding of their areas of responsibility and to avoid overlapping mandates and getting in each other way and creating fatigue by supervision for the institutions that are that have to comply with these measures. So we can move to the next slide. In respect of life insurers, the comments that were received were mainly proposing that certain types of life insurance products, especially what is commonly known as peer risk life insurance, in other words, life insurance that doesn't have an investment component or an endowment component, should be excluded from the scope of the FIC Act. As we've said in a very summary fashion when the public hearings were held, the current scope of the FIC Act The status quo currently is that there's no exclusion for any type of life insurance in the scope of the FRCA. So a provider of long-term insurance or life insurance is fully covered regardless of the type of product or the type of insurance policy that they offer to their customers. This proposed change would therefore narrow the scope of the FRCA by excluding certain types of insurance. And it would be difficult for us to make a convincing argument that it's such a narrowing of the current scope is justified. When the FRCA was amended in 2017, there were a number of exemptions in place that excluded certain categories of business, including certain categories of life insurance from where, in respect of particular types of transactions, institutions would not have to comply with the FRCA, even though they were accountable institutions. So it did not exclude the institution from the scope of the Act, but the institution did not have to comply with the FRCA in certain instances because of those exemptions that were in place. It was a considered decision at that time to withdraw those exemptions because of the implementation of the risk-based approach that I mentioned just now. And because of the need for institutions now to determine whether they have an exposure to money laundering risk and what they need to do to mitigate that risk, where that decision cannot be taken on behalf of the institution by the authorities, by the regulators, or by the minister. This was also pointed out to us in comments that were received in the minister's consultation process, including by some service providers in the insurance industry, that we would create a confusion with the risk-based approach by including certain exclusions from the scope of the FRC Act for insurers that would then in certain instances be an accountable institution and simultaneously in other instances not be an accountable institution. And that would complicate life for the insurance industry and for the supervisors, for the regulators, etc. To determine when is the institution an accountable institution and when are they not, and therefore beyond the scope of the supervisor. We can move to the next slide. I think just to reiterate the point that the risk-sensitive or the risk-based approach that is applied at industry level require life insurers, as with any other accountable category of accountable institution, to determine when they should increase the level of compliance. In other words, apply enhanced measures to know more about their customer or to intensify the verification of the information that they have about their customer and when they can apply simplified measures where that's not necessary. Now, simplified measures can be something as simple as having a name and identity number for a customer. There's no prescription on what enhanced measures should be or what simplified.
Product recording in progress.
The insurer provides to the general public, but that it would provide to another insurer who would also be an accountable institution. So we can move to the next slide. In respect of credit providers, there were a few comments again suggesting that the narrowing of the drafting of this item or the exclusion of certain economic sectors from the scope of this item. On the narrowing of the drafting, it was proposed that it should only include certain types of credit transactions. In other words, that it should cover credit providers except for, and then certain proposals were made that would, for instance, exclude the typical line of credit business, credit facilities, or installment payment transactions, which in the credit legislation, is, National Credit Act is referred to as credit transactions. And in these cases, the effect of such an exclusion would be that the majority of all forms of consumer credit, including mortgage bonds, credit cards, installment sales for finance leases and those sort of things would be excluded from the scope of the FRC Act. That would not be meeting the objective of this proposed amendment. And it would certainly create a problem, again, in terms of the scope of what's required to be covered under this item from the international standards perspective. In the FATF standards, this category of business is referred to as lending business, and the standards are very explicit that lending business includes consumer credit, it includes mortgage credit, it includes finance leasing and things like that. So it would be again difficult for us to justify why we are not following the international standard in this respect. We can move to the next slide. This is the last item that we'll be sort of picking up on the themes from the comments. In respect of high value goods dealers, many of the comments on this item focused on narrowing down the item to concentrate on cash transactions only. In other words, where high value goods are purchased with cash. And some of the comments were also proposing to exclude certain economic sectors from the scope of this item. There were also proposals that this should only be focused on the retail sector, should not include wholesales, the wholesale sector in the scope of these transactions. We can move to the next slide in our responses to these comments. First off, I think it's important, and this question also came up in the public hearings, make the point that this, the reason why this item is being included is not to focus on capturing details about cash transactions. It is about capturing the details of transactions where people have the spending power and can afford from their disposable income to buy expensive items. And the intent, therefore, is to create an audit trail for those occasions where a person can afford to make these high-value purchases and to ensure that the information is captured and recorded properly and that there is some form of identification that takes place at the time of those transactions. It is also important to note that this category includes some of the categories of non-financial institutions that the FATF standard requires us to include, such as dealers in precious metals, dealers in stones, which typically would include jewelers, etc. The importance of this category and what we found from experience in the FRC, the implementation of the FRC Act thus far, is that it is very prevalent for people that fund their lifestyle from criminal activity to spend money, not incur credit, but spend money, spend their disposable income on items that typically go with a luxurious lifestyle or expensive vehicles, art, etc. And those would be the things that would also fall in this category. The importance of capturing the information and ensuring that we have an audit trail for those transactions, I think will also be important in future as further initiatives, for instance, to have better control from a taxation point of view on the lifestyle that certain individuals can afford to lead, become more in focus, and we can combine the information from the regulatory side, from the taxation side, and from the investigative side to form a picture of a person's lifestyle. We can move to the next slide. On Schedule 2 of the FIC Act, this is the schedule that determines the supervisory bodies. In other words, determines which regulators are responsible for supervising compliance with the FIC Act. The one comment that was received suggested that the JSE should be the supervisor for authorized users of exchanges. Now, authorized users are determined by the Financial Markets Act, if I remember correctly, and they are brokers that are members of an exchange, and therefore through their membership of an exchange are able to bring together buyers and sellers of shares on that exchange of listed companies. And the JSE's proposal is therefore that the JSE should supervise brokers on exchanges. Now, our response, our view on that comment is that the supervision of that category of business, that financial institutions that provide broking services, is entrusted to the FSCA. The JSE is responsible for applying the rules of the JSE to the members of the JSE, but not generally to supervise the conduct or the activity of broking stockbrokers in general. It's also important now that there are other exchanges in the market that are licensed to trade listed securities. So to keep in mind that the JSE has no authority to supervise members of other exchanges. They can only supervise their own members who are authorized to trade on the JSE. So in our view, it would not be appropriate for the JSE to be the supervisor for compliance with the FIC Act for authorized users or for stockbrokers in general. We can move to the next slide. I think just gives a view of how, and this comes back to the point that Momo made right in the beginning, how we envisage rolling out these amendments, especially the treatment of the new sectors that will become accountable institutions and have not in the past been accustomed to complying with the FIC Act or have not had much contact with the sort of obligations that the FIC Act requires of institutions under its scope. It's important to understand that all of these new categories that are brought in under the scope of the FIC Act are generally considered to be vulnerable sectors. And that is why it's important that the FIC Act provisions are applied in those sectors and why those sectors need to mitigate risk and protect themselves from being exploited by their customers. That's also why these institutions have been identified in the international standards to be included as non-financial institutions and all the financial institutions such as credit providers. For these new categories, the credit providers, the trust and company service providers, crypto asset service providers, dealers and high value goods, the FIC will become the default supervisor for compliance with the FIC Act. That is also the consequence of the schedule changes that will be that are part of these proposed amendments. This will entail, firstly, that these entities would have to register with the FIC so that the FIC then would have a record of the entities that are operating in these various categories of accountable institutions and have an ability to reach out to those institutions in those categories, make contact with them. And that is very important from our point of view, because a large part, especially in the initial period of the implementation of these amendments, will require the formulation of guidance, and it will require the raising of awareness and understanding in these new sectors. And that can be facilitated by having access to industry bodies or arranging events such as webinars for industry sectors, workshops, etc. That will be part of the awareness raising process, but it will also require contact with individual institutions, that is part and parcel of the work that the FIC does in what is normally referred to as compliance visits, where FIC officials would visit an institution, discuss compliance with the FIC Act with no punitive aspect to this. It's not an inspection. There's no findings made. There's no sanctions applied in the case of those compliance visits. But it is meant to improve the understanding of compliance with the FIC Act, and to recommend ideas for the institution to consider in implementing to improve its compliance. Now, all of that is done on a risk-based approach, and the FIC, therefore, would have to also undertake sectoral risk assessments for each of these new categories to understand among them where is risk more pertinent, and within an industry, what type of institution in that industry is at a higher level of risk of being used for money laundering or terror financing compared to institutions within that industry that may be at a lower risk. And because each of these items cover quite a disparate range of institutions within each sector, it's important for the FIC to have that understanding of risk, and for the FIC to focus its resources where it will have the most impact and achieve the best outcome on an 80-20 principle from compliance with the FIC Act. So that will take up much of the initial work and engagement with these industries. When guidance is formulated, that must be done in collaboration and consultation with the affected industry. So again, contact with the industries, either directly with institutions or via industry bodies, is absolutely required for the FIC to be able to formulate guidance on compliance with those industries. The FIC and not just the FIC, but the current supervisors in the financial sector as well, have come to understand over the years with the implementation of the FIC Act that institutions, especially new categories of institutions, are not able to comply with the FIC Act, even if they have a good understanding of what it means. They don't have the capacity or the means in their businesses to immediately meet all the expectations of compliance with the FIC Act. And a common practice that supervisors follow is to allow this time for institutions through engagement with the supervisors to bed down compliance, bed down systems, policies that may be necessary. Again, depending on the complexity and the size of the organization, the institution, and to engage the industries for that period that may be necessary for compliance to be bedded down, and not to impose, not to take any enforcement actions during that period, but to work with the institutions on a compliance improvement process. This was also followed, this exact process was followed in following 2017, when the amendments to the FIC Act fundamentally changed the paradigm from a rules-based to a risk-based process, which was even a challenge for very sophisticated institutions such as banks, et cetera, to implement. So this risk-based approach, the understanding of the necessity to focus resources where the impact will be more meaningful is as much required of the supervisors, including the FRC, as it is of the institutions that have to comply with the FRC Act. We can move to the next slide. Okay, yeah, I think that is the last slide of the presentation. So Mama, I'll hand back to you. I'm not sure if you want to further pick up on some of these points, but we are then also available to answer questions. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thanks, Peter. So, Chair and Honourable Members, I think you've seen our response. Some of it is driven in terms of, obviously, the FATF standards, but I wanted to emphasise that I think in the main, we want to do these provisions for ourselves and to improve our capability and mechanisms to deal with financial crimes. And I think, you know, it's when we expand these to other sectors, there's always resistance because there are cost implications for businesses. But we do think that, I think the challenge will be in the implementation and in getting the risk-based approach to be applied in a way that's proportionate. Almost by definition, that's what risk-based is. And I think that's, even once these schedules are in effect, that's an engagement that needs to happen with each of those sectors. But they clearly are important, I think, to proceed with. But we'll stop there, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Mr. Smith and Momo. Letting me invite honorable members who want to make comments and ask clarity seeking questions to do so. Dr. George, over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks very much for the presentation. I've got three questions. The first one is that my understanding is that one of the problems that the FATF had was that we were not holding to account those individuals and groups that are committing money laundering or, you know, facilitating the proceeds of crime and financing terrorism, etc., that they were not being held to account, not being prosecuted, not being caught, etc. So how will the law that is now being changed deal with that problem? Because, I mean, obviously you can make any law as tight as you want to, but the proof really is in the implementation and then the consequences for those people who break the law and behave in an inappropriate way. So I think that's the first question. The second question is that I'm not quite sure how the FATF process works. Now, obviously, a year ago in October, almost, yeah, they issued some recommendations. And now, of course, we're responding, changing FICA and various other acts. They would then have to apply their mind to, once we've processed this law, whether they're satisfied that it covers the problems. And then they would have to then decide whether it's good enough straight away or whether there needs to be time to see whether they work or something. But my understanding is that that decision is going to get made somewhere in February. So what's concerning me here is that there are significant changes here. The industry is very concerned about them because it does cost more to comply then, obviously. However, it is necessary for us to do something about the problem that we have because we really do need to comply. So what we obviously don't know what the outcome will be, but what is that process that we can, you know, monitor? And then finally, this is the burning question that I think on everybody's mind is, we got the report from FATF apparently last year already in October. I don't know all the details, but that's my understanding. We are now in August, a year, nearly a year later, and we are running out of time. So what happened, as we saw in the committee, that we have to move with speed. We have actually is a lot of pressure on everybody, frankly, the industries, et cetera, all those affected, because we're now on this burning platform. And when you're on a burning platform, you might very well make mistakes, or you take a very blunt instrument to a sort of problem that needs fine tuning. I mean, the
Dr. George is having a problem of connectivity.
A question that needs to be asked. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Dr. George. Any other question or comment? Can you respond to those questions asked by Dr. George in the meantime?
Sure. Thank you, Chair. I miss what he was, he froze. So I don't know what his last question was, but let me just try and start off and Honorable George can tell us if we've answered his last question, whatever it was. I think that those are actually very relevant questions. Obviously, these schedules are just part of the story, but in terms of the process, yes, if you look at the mutual evaluation, just to remind honorable members, there's two aspects of it when they reviewed us. The first aspect is that there are 40 FATF recommendations, okay? And they use the word recommendations, but they mean standards that members commit to complying with. And secondly, there's effectiveness measures. And there they have 11 measures, and they call them in their jargon immediate outcomes. And our problem is that we were weak on 20 of the 40 recommendations. We got the two low categories, and which is effectively a fail. And on the 11 immediate outcomes, I think we got three that were
recording in progress.
Going to make up for it effectively in hopefully a year and a half or a year and a quarter. So what we've done is we've got cabinet approval to bring in a general laws anti-money laundering and something bill, which cabinet's approved, and which as we speak, the state law advisors have certified. And our staff are reading the first proofs, and hopefully by tomorrow they'll do the second proofs. And we're really hoping that on Thursday, they will be formally tabled or introduced in a National Assembly for the committee to consider. So what those will do, and we are under pressure to have them passed before the end of the year. And if we were to achieve that, that bill will deal with, I don't know offhand, but I think 14 of the 20 recommendations. There's another bill, I think it's, don't ask me, it's a prevention of Pop the Tara bill, which the Minister of Safety and Security introduced in July. And they deal with two of the recommendations. They're really important recommendations because There's three core recommendations that we fail on. We have to pass those. And those will be passed, sorry, those two of the three core are in that bill. So that takes account of 16. Now, even though we don't have to meet all of them in one go necessarily, the other four will deal with through regulations and other processes. They don't need hard legislative changes. Okay, so that's our assessment of the bills. So we think, and what FATF requires by February when we go to the plenary, that basically those laws are also in effect. They can't just be passed by Parliament, enacted into law by the President by signing it into an act, but they also have to have taken effect. So that's what we're going to have to do. And they relate to beneficial ownership and all the gaps that there are in our current legislative and regulatory framework. So we think that we should be able to pass. And let me say, it will be a huge step forward in South Africa making real progress and demonstrating that we've made progress on our anti-money laundering and terror financing framework. But it's not going to be enough. We have to do much more than that. We have to show that we have the capability and the will to implement those laws. And I guess that's what gets into the issues of on the 11th. There's, you know, whether, firstly, if you take a step back, I think what FATF is saying, we've been naive that we're really dealing with criminal syndicates and South Africa's capability to deal with criminal syndicates is poor. You need to have a proper risk assessment, a national risk assessment, a credible one, that gets all the authorities aligned. So that's one of the things we're working on. We're almost there with it, we think. And that will deal with one of the 11, to have a credible national risk assessment for money laundering and terror financing. So just by having a credible plan, we'll pass one of the 11. Then we'll have to show that there's what we call number three, four, and five are more with how we regulate. So these schedules will certainly come in. How do our regulators, when they deal with money laundering, do they have a document that says this is how they do it? Do they have a manual? They can't just say we do risk-based assessment. They actually have to have it as part of their routine work and have manuals so that there's consistency in their approach. And you know, we think that certainly the financial sector regulators should be able to pass the test, and they've got to demonstrate that they are implementing beneficial ownership and making it available to the criminal justice authorities, that it's readily available. So that should deal with 3, 4, and 5. But within that, there's many what's called the designated non-financial sector providers. And some of them are covered here, but others are already covered. So it would be the legal profession, it would be casinos, it would be, gambling institutions, it would be motor car dealers, estate agents, etc. And some of these other ones that we're dealing with in the schedule will be covered by that. Now, there's no supervisors. That's why we're saying that necessarily that there may not be any supervisors, because some of them may just be pure registrations. And that's where the FIC is coming in to try and fill the gap. So we think we should be able to make progress in 3, 4, and 5. Then comes the tough part. So number 2, 6, 7, and 8 deal with the Hawks, the NPA, the police, asset for feature unit. Do we investigate money laundering and related crimes? Take state corruption. It's mentioned in the report. Are there investigations? Are there prosecutions? Are there asset for features? we're going to have to demonstrate that our authorities are actually succeeding and have made progress. And then there's 9, 10, and 11, and it's also linked to 2. And by the way, 2 is, are we then trying to get the money from Dubai or Hong Kong or America or the UK or Switzerland, wherever the money has gone to? Our authorities trying to get back the money that was stolen from us. Then there's 9, 10, and 11. That is where the, on terror financing, you know, the concern there, I should add, is not just terror financing for acts conducted in South Africa, but South Africa is seen as a financial hub. And many, and there's some evidence that such groups come into operating in South Africa, which is like a safe haven, and able to then fund other movements and so on, or actions in our continent and elsewhere. And that's where we need to demonstrate much more progress. And so you get our intelligence agencies and the police, and also when the UN Security Council designates some people, we've committed by international agreement to follow through. We've not followed through for 5 years currently, okay? You know, it sits with safety and security or in that domain, and they haven't moved on that. So those are the issues that come up. And I think we can make progress on 8, 9, 10, and 11. That should be reasonably easy. The toughest is definitely in the criminal justice system, where we'll have to demonstrate progress. So in terms of the process, what happens? We have to give a first report at the end of August. We'll be just on the technical compliance and legislation. We'd be able to say at least that, look, we're doing this. We've tabled the two bills and they're before Parliament. Hopefully by October, if we can show that we've made progress, that, for example, one of the, in the assembly, we've made, you know, the committees are at an advanced stage, or it would be nice to say that the NA has already adopted it or close to adoption, and that it's on its way to the NCOP. And hopefully we can then report that by the end of the year, we think we're reasonably confident it will be passed by Parliament and then enacted into law. So the first report, end of August, second report, end of October. That's the bigger report. We'll have to demonstrate on the technical compliance. We'll also have to demonstrate the effectiveness by then. So we are busy, and we've been very busy, Chair, meeting with departments, with agencies, with different clusters, so that they can report on the progress that they've made. They can say, we've got our manual, our risk to do risk-based assessments. They can say, we've had so many cases, and this is where we are. If we can do that for all the immediate outcomes and show that there's sufficient progress, look, it's going to be very tough. The chances are we'll get waitlisted, but I still think we can avoid it if we demonstrate progress, and I think we can, okay? And so what will happen is there's a joint group done with the regional body, Asamale, and the Fatah Secretariat. I want Peter and them to just correct me to get the process exactly right. But what we then do is over December, we talk to them. There's a lot of the to and fro on the info. And in January, we'll have meetings. We're not going to be able to take any December break. To prepare, we'll have a 4-hour or 5-hour session with the joint group to then deal with any outstanding issues that we've not dealt with. So that's the process. Then we go to the Fatah plenary in February. And that's where we need to, they will look at the joint group's report. And if we've satisfied everything there, hopefully they'll approve it and we're not on the gray list. We'll still be under possibly enhanced follow-up, still to follow up, because we have to show consistency that we've changed over time. So we'd still be on such a list. But even if we do get onto the gray list, hopefully it will only be a few items and we'll have our own action plans, not action plans imposed on us, which we'll have to follow through with. So that is the process. And maybe just to add that the General Laws Amendment Bill changes 5 laws. It changes the FIC Act, it changes the Financial Sector Regulation Act, the Companies Act, the Nonprofit Organizations Act, and our current Trust Act. I forget the name, the exact name. And in fact, the challenge is going to be it's all in one bill. How does Parliament, what process does it have to bring the different committees to process the bill? We are in discussions. I know our minister has written to the speaker just to get some guidance from Parliament, and no doubt the minister, after the bill is tabled and you see, we may need to engage or just to answer any questions Parliament may have, but obviously it's Parliament will guide on exactly how the process should work. But that's going to be the challenge that we have. So that, I think, I don't know, Peter or any of my colleagues, do you want to just add on to that in terms of the FATF process? Have I missed anything? Have I got anything slightly wrong? I don't know if you can come before I answer the other question.
Thanks, Mama. I think I don't have anything else to add.
Okay, thanks, Peter. Honorable George, I think that covers both your first two questions. Your third one, you cut out, so I'm not sure if it's been answered, Honorable Chair. If not, Honorable Chair, you can guide us and just repeat the question so we can answer it. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Dr. Schlope, you want to clarify something?
Yes, Chairperson, I do. But there's a number of questions that I have here.
Chairperson, I did have a third question. That the acting DG did not get the last one. So would I have the opportunity then to just put that question again?
Oh, it was by the time we couldn't hear you. You lost connectivity, as you have heard the acting DG that it didn't hear you very well.
Yes, I understand.
Bring that question back again. Dr. Schlope, I'll come back to you.
Okay, thank you, Chair. I'm not sure why my connectivity is problematic, but please just alert me if I disappear, but it shouldn't happen. Thanks very much for your responses on that. It does clarify things. My question was, the last question was that we got the report last year in August, I understand. Now we are in August a year later, and we are now on a burning platform. So my question is, I understand what the acting DG said about, you know, engagement with departments, etc., and this is complicated. We know this, but it is a very long time. And now we are scrambling, in my view. We're going to move obviously as fast as we possibly can, but these things take time. So what I want to know is, why has it taken so long for the Treasury to be responding urgently? Because this is a major problem. Because also, I mean, we heard from the governor of the Reserve Bank a few days ago, and now we're hearing also from the acting DG. And I mean, we all have brains, so we can all think about it clearly. It looks... obviously, we hope it doesn't happen, but hope is not a strategy. But it looks like it's going to happen, that we're going to get grey listed. And as the acting DG also said, we then need to plan for that. So, and also the governor of the Reserve Bank said, if we get grey listed, we've got to get offered as fast as possible. But obviously, if you need to implement, so you have to change the law, you have to implement it and then demonstrate that it's, they probably want to see us demonstrating that it's working. So there is a process. So I think we're going to end up grey listed, unfortunately, but we need a plan for that, as was alluded to. So I'm sure that we will get something in terms of how we're going to respond if that does happen, because we've got to manage risk. But that was the question, is why has it taken this long? Because now it feels like we're on a burning platform and the inevitable looks likely that we're going to get grey listed. And that is my concern, that there was not a fast enough response to this very, very significant event. Because if you look at Pakistan, I'm sure you've done all the research anyway, but I've done some too. If you look at what happened to Pakistan, there was a definite impact on the economy, very significantly. And the research is very clear. So I think we can expect something similar then. But anyway, that's the question. Thanks, Chair, for allowing that.
Okay, thanks, Dr. Church. Then you, okay, let me also bring Dr. Klope so that they can respond to all the questions at once.
Thank you very much, Chair. Just a few questions of clarity. I've added them in the chat in case I'm not clear enough. It seems as if there is this regulation of some new sectors in order to determine the risk of money laundering. Is this not an expensive way of doing it? Why not assess the risk first and have that national risk assessment of money laundering before expanding the regulatory net and include new businesses on which the risk you clearly do not know very well of how much laundering is taking place through them? The second question is on the high value goods. Does this also include high value services? For instance, you know, sophisticated criminals, they send their kids to very expensive schools, like everyone in society who's got money to do so. They enjoy medical health, which is expensive, expensive bills in restaurants and clubs and private aviation services. Are these kinds of things covered in this definition of high value goods? If not, why not? Is it not maybe because we don't have this risk assessment that is required before you regulate? The third question is, how many new individual businesses and persons will be affected by the amendments? So which means parties that were not regulated before but now are going to be regulated. And if they register with the FIC, do they pay annual levies for that registration? If so, how much is it? And what are the cost implications of all of this, especially on these new businesses and small businesses? And those are my questions, Chair. Thanks.
Thanks. Momo and Peter, I think I also raised it last week. Saika and others are very worried about the impact that these schedules are going to have on the SMEs. I don't have to repeat what they said. It is in their submission, financially and otherwise. So they are not saying that they don't want to comply, but they're saying the financial burden will be very heavy on small practitioners. How do we mitigate that? We comply, but not on the expense of SMEs. Any economy that is very strong surely rely on the SMEs. Once an economy relies on the monopoly companies, it is going to be in serious trouble. So is this not going to destroy the SMEs that are there? And as I've said, I don't have to rehash what they said, but I was very, very worried about that concern. Take us in simple detail how that will be mitigated. Because we will comply tomorrow, only to find that the other day SMEs collapses. And our economy is not doing well. So many young people are unemployed and so on and so on. So let's deal with that. Momo, I hear you making a very, very strong statement. I don't know, in a public platform like this. Are you saying that South Africa is a haven of criminals or terrorists who are doing money laundering? Did I hear you to say that, or I didn't get you well? Clarify that, because if that's what you said in a parliamentary platform like this, it has got serious impact out there. It will be like, instead of marketing our country, we're telling the whole world that here we are, we can't even deal with criminals there. It's like one government official, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago, saying that criminals have taken over South Africa. I don't think we have reached that stage. So if you can clarify me in that regard, or you wanted to convey something while dealing with the issue of criminals. Over to you, Momo and Peter.
No, thanks, Chair. And let me start with the last point you made, Chair. I think, firstly, when you look at the FATF mutual evaluation, firstly, if you read between the lines, effectively it's saying that our system is not geared to deal with criminal syndicates, and that there is a concern that it's taken root. Now, if you look at our own newspaper reports, I mean, there was a report, for example, on the construction mafia, or what they call local business forums, and the whole 30% fee story. When we talk to, I know in government interactions with business, if you look at in the construction industry, it's a huge problem. It's there. And these criminal syndicates are operating. If you look at the problem of scrap steel and how these networks work, if you look at the problem of, as we've seen, Zama-Zamas, okay? These are all driven by clear economic interests. There's a whole value chain. And, you know, we often only deal with, even when we do prosecute, you know, it's like, I guess, the drugs trade, the illegal drugs trade, that you're dealing with the runners on the ground, and not really the ultimate beneficiaries. A lot of that has taken root. And I think that as a society, we've got to accept the level of corruption, the level of criminal syndicates has become deeply rooted, because effectively we don't investigate. We're seen as a safe haven by such networks. And I think that we are in real trouble. To what extent are we a mafia state, a criminal state, you know, gangs driving it? We can debate it, but it's a real problem. It's there. And we've got to somehow take back our country. And certainly when you look at internal discussions that are taking place, like on scrap steel and those goods, as you can see what's happened to our rail system and so on, these are driven by syndicates. It's not just ordinary people going and getting steel. Somebody's buying. And I think, Chair, it does get to difficult issues, like if you look at some of the findings in the Zondo Commission, the problem of Bosasa, as we saw. How do you deal with the cash economy? Where clearly a lot of these transactions are in cash, perhaps, not really through the banking system. So we can have a good banking system. The FIC will get reports on suspicious transaction records, cash transaction records, but those are through the banking system. How do they pick it up when it gets to, Dr. Shlopi's question on high value goods or services? It's only through those motor car dealers, expensive houses, that you're going to perhaps find way.
Recording in progress. Recording in progress.
But the impact is it impacts on our electricity to the country. So that the effect of these, because they're affecting whole networks, is massive. And we clearly, in any national risk assessment plan, all of those areas will have to be highlighted. The Zama problem or illegal mines, that will need to be addressed as well. And our authorities then will need to, in a sense, those priorities or those risks will determine where they're going to put most of their resources when investigating crimes. So let me say, Chair, I'm certainly I won't even say expert. I'm not someone who's familiar with the area of crime and so on. But just watching these reports, and from an economic perspective, we can see the damage that it's wreaking. Now, let me just answer the specific questions. So just to finish on the small business, there's no doubt that this can impose costs. And again, it's only through having a risk-based approach and saying, listen, these small businesses, it's really not an issue, and have almost no reporting requirements on them. But on some, we're going to have to impose. And we can't really wait to say, let's have a risk-based approach and then do the schedules. Unfortunately, we have to do both because we can't exclude them, as Peter Smith has explained in the Act. But then how we apply them, sector, subsector by subsector, is going to be the challenge. That we're not imposing costs on areas that are low risk. And most businesses, I believe, will be low risk, small businesses. I think what SAICA was looking at is SMEs and looking at accountants who they don't normally represent, but saying, how will you impact on that? But we're going to have to deal with those specific professions as well. So, Chair, by the time we go in February, I think we must just have the legislative mechanisms and move on the high risk. The rest of it, it's in our interest to move on, but we can hopefully get, we will have, I think, more time to act on them. I don't think it's reasonable to expect that we are going to solve our problems by February. We're not. And we're not signaling that to FATF in our reports. So starting with a burning platform, a year is not a long time. And Honorable George is right. We have been scrambling since the report. We've had to move very fast. And yes, perhaps we could have moved faster by 2-3 months, faster in some of these measures. But, when I look back, I do try and think, how could we have done it faster? But in a sense, we are where we are. But we have consulted. So if you look at the legislation, we have rushed it. And I think the comment period is going to be important. And we'll definitely have to make some changes because it does. We will have limited public consultation. Normally, we would have liked more time. But just getting all the departments on board, doing a lot of persuading about why, let's take the nonprofit sector. Many don't see why they should be included, or speaking to the departments that are overseeing them. They don't have that regulatory approach yet. So to strengthen that, I think is pretty tough. And so it's taken a bit of time. And I think the key issue is if you look at that, I think we're still within time, as I said, to get the legislation to do the technical compliance. And hopefully through the public consultation process, we can reduce some of the risk when you are forced to do something in a hurry. And on the implementation side, you don't have to wait for the law. There's been lots of meetings that we've had with all the authorities, relevant ones. In fact, there's too many. We haven't met, say, maybe sufficiently with the legal profession yet to see how they can have a risk-based approach. But certainly with the core ones, whether it's the Hawks, the NPA, Asset for Future Unit, or State Security Services, we've been having lots of meetings to try and get them on board. And it does require quite fundamental changes often from them as well, to see how we can respond. And as I said, there are areas that we're still not going to be able to cover, like the area of cash or the Hawala system. Some of them will even say they're small businesses, but those are clearly the high-risk ones that we have to cover. We have to deal with the construction industry, the construction mafia. I mean, whose responsibility is it? To deal with it. It's again, the prosecuting authorities have to be able to act. So they're going to have to see what the high risks are and that they believe in the national risk assessment that will be produced and actually implementing it. So we can't really do the NRA first. I think we have to include the sectors, but the challenge, the approach is then to risk assess as we go through. In terms of high-value services, Peter, you can come in and answer that one. But clearly, generally, when you look at the approach, you do need to go beyond the individual to those that are connected to that individual, what services they are enjoying. And I would imagine that services would be covered. But again, you need to go profession by profession or service by service to ensure that they are covered. But I'll let Peter come in on that in a second. I'm almost done. As I said, there may be costs on high-risk ones, especially. So we're not saying there's no cost. We're not saying, and if this is enforced in a draconian way, it will have huge economic, it can have significant economic implications on a small business. I think the challenge here is for us to come and account. And once the risk-based approaches are put in place, to see that we've excluded most small businesses effectively because they are low risk. That's what we're going to have to do. And these processes will ensure that they are transparent, there's public comments taken, and so we can hopefully reach an accommodation or balance that's a sensible one. Entities don't really pay levies to the FIC. But again, as you saw with the financial sector levies bill, which is currently before the NCOP, we are getting many financial institutions to pay for the cost of regulating them or supervising them. And certainly down the line, when we look at high-risk sectors, these should be incorporated. This risk should be incorporated in their regulatory fees. It's not necessarily there at the moment, but something that we can deal with later. Peter, do you want to come in or anyone else in our delegation and just deal with that high value services?
Yes, thanks, Mom. So the drafting of this item that's currently proposed in the amendment to the schedule does not include people or institutions that provide services. It specifically refers to items, and the item is typically a physical thing. So when a physical thing that you can touch is being sold for a price of 100,000 rand or more, that would fall within the scope of this item. The reason why we've focused on this is firstly, on an 80-20 principle, if we want to expand this even wider to include also service providers where you're not dealing with tangible things that are being bought and sold, the scope becomes so wide that it really becomes impossible to regulate and supervise from a supervisory impact perspective. So we will achieve very little by expanding the scope even further. But if one thinks about it, a person who generally can spend this amount of money on buying expensive items will also be in that category of the same type of spender that would be spending their disposable income on expensive schools and education for children and houses and other things. So even though that category is not captured, the same category of people will come in touch with institutions in various items that would have to identify the person, capture their details, etc. So the audit trail will be picked up regardless. And I think that's the objective of what we're trying to achieve. We're not trying for 100% coverage. We're trying to achieve enough coverage so that we can pick up the audit trail that can start off an investigation, collect the information, etc. Mama, I just want to quickly touch on one or two other things on small businesses and the cost of compliance and the registration. And there's also a question of the number of new entities that we expect will come into the scope of the FIC. I'll ask Christopher Malan, who's responsible for that registration process, to just say a few words on that as well. The FIC does not charge a registration fee for registering. The FIC Act allows the FIC to, and any other supervisor, to recover the cost of an inspection, for instance, to check on compliance from the inspected institution, but we don't make use of that power. No, none of the supervisors so far have made use of that power to recover the cost of inspections, for instance, from the inspected institution. So we see that as part of our business, and we cover that from our budget allocations that are made available to us. So we don't charge or impose costs on institutions for registering or for being subject to our supervision. But the cost of compliance is a factor of the nature of the business and what they need to do in order to comply with the FIC Act. And cost is generally generated when the institution now has to do something new that it didn't do before so that it can comply with the FIC Act. So our approach to compliance is very much to see how does the institution run its business? What information does it generally collect about its customers? How much does it need to verify about its customers' identity, business, source of income, et cetera, in order to run a business? And we try to structure the compliance expectations from an institution around that so that it fits in with the way that the institution does business and the institution doesn't have to start doing something different or start doing something new. So typically, if the example of an accountant that incorporates a company for their customer would have to know a lot of information about that customer, would have to have verified that information so that they can draw up the memorandum of incorporation, so that they can file the papers with the CIPC, et cetera. And that already creates enough of an audit trail, again, captures enough information in the records, and there wouldn't be an expectation that in such a case, the accountant, for instance, in a run-of-the-mill incorporation process would have to do more in order to satisfy the obligations of the FIC Act, apart from the things like registration, etc. But where the institution deals with high-risk customers and high-risk business, they would have to do more. That's the point we were trying to make earlier, and I think Mama's touched on this as well. Even small businesses can get into high-risk business. And in those cases, they would have to do more to comply with the FIC Act. And that's how we're trying to mitigate the cost impact on institutions, because those would be the exception to the rule. And that is a function of the customer base, the type of services, the type of products that the business provides to their customers that would place it in a high-risk area of business. And where the business would have to have more secure verification of its customers' information and have a better understanding of its customers' business so that it can identify when something needs to be reported to the FIC. So the cost implication is inherently mitigated or determined by the framework of the FIC Act that requires institutions to protect themselves from being exploited by money launderers, criminals that want to use the business for as a front for banking their criminal proceeds or for channeling their proceeds out of the country. Christopher, I hope you're online and can come in on the question on the new entities, because we have done some estimate on that, and we have actually been in discussion with the industries that were identified for inclusion for some time. And in order to prepare the proposals for the minister in the consultation process that he initiated in June 2020. So there has been a long period of engagement with the different industries, and for us to get a good feel of the type of businesses and the numbers that we would expect to bring into the scope of the FIC. So with your permission, Mr. Chair and Mamo, if I can ask Christopher to also talk a bit about that. Thanks.
Good morning, Chairperson, honourable members, colleagues. On the issue of the numbers, we made it a very important part of our consultation process that when consulting, we got a sense of estimated players then currently in the market for two reasons. Firstly, to get a sense of what the stress factor is going to be on the FIC systems to register them and keep these accounts up to date. And it is important that we do the link between the registration, because through registration, they are enabled to file reports to us. And one can argue that the entire FIC system or the anti-money laundering system is there for two purposes. Firstly, to enable the institutions to be better armed with control measures to prevent themselves being abused by the criminal elements that would seek to, you know, to make these entities a facilitator knowingly or unknowingly. So the whole rationale is through this mechanism, the institution is much more aware that it is in a vulnerable sector and is aware of what to look out for. They then confirm that via registration with us, because we do want them also to be a good corporate citizen, in the sense that once they are aware that they can be subject to abuse, they are then armed with knowledge to detect that abuse. And once they detect the abuse, they then would like them to report that activity to us. And the only way they can report to the FIC is through the registration platform. So that's why it's very critical we spend a lot of time estimating the universe and ensuring we know who would be in the universe, so that when we do outreach, we seek to get the entire universe registered with us. So what are the figures showing us? The credit providers we estimate would be about 6,400. On the high-value goods dealers, we are looking at focusing on the more prominent areas, about 12,500. The trust property service providers and the company service providers is quite a huge market. The reason why it's a huge market is that attorneys currently and accountants and other financial advisors do play a role in advising persons to set up structures for ordinary business purposes, but also for illegal purposes, unknowingly, one could argue. And there we're looking at a scan of approximately, and as I said, it includes attorneys, it would include accountants that are operating in this environment and other financial advisors and the like, about 5,000. On the crypto assets, we have had very extensive engagements with them. They are quite a eager industry to be within the regulatory net of registration, because it gives them the credibility they seek so dearly. And we have effectively already registered on a voluntary basis close to 100 of those entities. So we do seek to be very forthcoming as well. We have registered them as in the remittance cross-border category. Once they are formally itemized, we will move them into the new item scheduled. The property practitioners, depending on market conditions, they fluctuate, as you know. When the economy goes down, less houses get sold. When the economy goes up, there's a boom and people sell houses. So there's approximately 9,000, and those are the estimates from the regulatory authority. From the law societies and the legal practice council, their estimates to us is about 16,000. And there are approximately 5,000 gaming institutions. Not all of them are new sectors, but I'm giving you a sense of the extent and size of the non-financial sector that we will be taking responsibility for. The first responsibility is obviously to register all of them, to enable them to understand they are subject to being abused, and secondly, to arm them with the means to report to the FIC. And flowing from that, once they're registered with us, we will engage with them on a quite an extensive education and awareness program to enable them to be part of the crime fighting issue, and first and foremost, to protect their own businesses from being abused. Thank you.
Thank you, Christopher. Chair, if I may just end off, I think, you know, I just wanted to also comment. I mean, I think what Honorable George said, you know, it's going to be hard to prevent grey listing, but I think we can really make significant progress. And if we do, and let's say there's only one or two or three areas, it means that the action plans that we almost get imposed on us will cover very little, and we can get out of it quite quickly. That's why the challenge is that for each of these areas, if we look at the national risk assessment, that we really cover, you know, the entire ground. We're looking at the recommended actions that FATF had certainly come up with. At the very least, we have to show progress against those, IO by IO, the 11 measures, immediate outcomes by immediate outcomes, and have in place our own plan so that nothing has to be imposed on us if you want to get off the grey listing. At least, even if we've not made progress, but we have a plan, it will hold us in good stead. But as I said, and I've seen the banking CEOs, I think some of them, I mean, I understand it is a high risk, but I think they, to be honest, you know, very few people, financial analysts and so on, this grey listing threat has come as a bit of a shock, because we are the first FATF member being placed like this. The others, like Pakistan or Malta or Mauritius, are not members of FATF, they belong to regions. So many are just beginning to understand the FATF process, and the FATF process is extremely confusing. And their language, I think, is very hard to really interpret. And I think, you know, those assessors have their own methodology and so on. One needs to understand that. So many of your investment analysts actually don't really understand the process. I think economically, yes, it will be negative. I'm not convinced it's as negative. If we've demonstrated action, and we've got to demonstrate, we've got to communicate. So let's take correspondent banks. If they see that we've now changed these laws and we passed the technical compliance, that we made real assessment on the risk-based approaches, that our banking sector is safe, you can reduce the cost to the banking system coming from the correspondent banks, because we still need access to the dollar, to the pound, to the renminbi, you know, so wherever the banks, overseas banks are with their currency, that they continue to have confidence in our banking system, even if the issue may be in our prosecuting agencies and investigative agencies. And as I said, the big concern is about, I guess, the role of these syndicates of corruption. If you look at the and state capture, that's been is written all over the place in the Fatah report that, you know, it's not that they're commenting on it. They say, but you say there's all of these things happening, but you have no prosecutions and your investigations, I guess, take very long. Are you using all the information that's available? So our agencies have to demonstrate that generally, they don't look at any specific case. They just have to demonstrate that generally this is how we deal with it. So I think that this threat is also an opportunity for us to fix up our ability to deal with financial crimes. And I think we can make huge progress. And I'm still confident. I haven't given up that we're going to prevent grey listing. I think we can demonstrate progress. So up to now, that's what we focused on. Yes, if it happens, you know, hopefully we'll have the plan and it will be very few items and can get out of it very quickly. So we are looking at that prospect. Thank you, Chair. I think we've answered all the questions. We don't have all the answers, let me emphasize. And there's many players. And it may be a good idea, even as you do the legislation with the general laws bill that's coming, Parliament finds a way of getting all the other authorities involved, especially in the criminal justice sector, to come and account as well in public about how they're responding to the recommended actions that have been proposed and what progress that they've made. That would all help us if there are such hearings before the end of the year. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks very much for the responses. I think I see, Dr. George, you want to make a follow-up question?
Yes, Chair, I did. Thank you very much for the responses. It is clear. I think as the acting DG said, you know, it's complicated and, you know, we are also an emerging player in this rather complicated arena. So it is what it is. Having said that, I also prefer to remain on the most positive side, look at the upside rather than the downside. I think that's very important. So at the same time, also try to mitigate as much as possible the problem that might be coming. So my question is this, given that we are not far from this decision that's going to get taken, and there is in fact a reasonably high probability that we would get greylisted, although we would all want it not to happen, and that there may well be something that happens that prevents that. We don't know that. So it's unknown and there's risk. So my question is this, has the Treasury applied its mind or started applying its mind on what we are going to do in the event that we are greylisted? I agree with you that with the acting director general that, you know, the consequences aren't completely known. The key thing is that what other jurisdictions do, because they might make it very difficult to move our money across borders, et cetera, impact trade and so on. So what do we do in the event that we are in fact greylisted and how we manage that? Because it's like if you're heading towards some kind of iceberg and you don't hit it, that's great. And we do everything not to. But in the event that you do, what is it that you have to do? And I think that's probably now a very important thing to consider. And I'd like to know whether the Treasury has been giving that at least some significant thought. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. George. Back to National Treasury and FIC.
So, yes, Chair, we are doing that. Look, we've been talking to various economists, various players in the market to try and understand specifically what the grey listing will mean, obviously for the economy as a whole, So we're still in a process of developing these, and we're very open to also getting, as you know, when it comes to economists, I mean, lots of people outside are doing their own assessment. The SAB will be doing its own. So, you know, we are in conversation with people. Perhaps we can do it a bit more systematically, and we will, so that we will have plans on that. It won't be a surprise. But some of it does depend on what progress, as I said, we make on the legislation and on those immediate outcomes, so we can understand, you know, which sectors will be negatively impacted. Because, and a lot is about both communication and what FATF will say. If FATF says, look, we've seen real progress, these guys have really tried, there's still these three areas, but we're happy with the banking sector as an example. That means that your correspondent banks are a bit more comfortable. So the detail of that will also depend on closer to it, like when we in December, January, talking to them, we'll begin to have a feel for where we've made good progress. And as I said, not all progress in this one, it's across government, other authorities and how they respond. But I take the point Dr. George is saying, Honorable George is saying, and certainly at some point, I think we'll make public our analysis as well, and certainly have plans to deal with, if we do get to grey listing, which as I said, is likely, but we're still trying to avoid it, Chair. But we need to look at all options. Can I say, Chair, just as I end, I mean, I've not found resistance within government. I've found real concern and real commitment to act to prevent this. The challenge is, can we actually do, you know, we may intend not to have it, but we have to do a lot more. We have to change our ways of working in many instances and our priorities. And as I said, you know, do you have a national risk assessment plan that you believe in and that it really guides your work and you're actually doing something about it? So that, I think, is a bigger challenge. Can we do what we say we want to do?
Okay. Dr. George, why are you so worried that you think there's a high likelihood that will be grey listed? Maybe you can share your concerns with us.
Chairperson, I think quite simply, given that I've worked in the financial industry for a long time and also been following this with great interest, and also that, you know, obviously I speak to many people in my job, and the international banking fraternity often speak to me and share their views on South Africa, etc. And this has been a long time coming. And we do know that we've had, what would you call them, problems with money laundering, money leaking out of the public sector, etc., and other problems, as the acting DG has said. And I think if you just simply look at the process, and if you look at how it all hangs together, it seems likely that it would happen. I mean, you know, you have to be realistic. It is absolutely right what the acting DG says, is that it's a complicated thing and it's an international thing, and we are a relatively small economy with lots of complexities. It just is a fact. So when you're dealing in that space, as a relatively small developing economy, it is difficult. That's just quite simple. So if you look at the signs, and you look at history of what happened to other countries, then, you know, I mean, obviously we wouldn't want it to happen, but it looks likely, because time is basically running out. the law needs to be changed clearly, it needs to be implemented, and there needs to be some kind of certainty, I would expect. I don't know the FATF at all, but clearly, if they're regulating, that's how they work, because it's processes, etc. So it is looking very likely. And as we all say, of course, we wouldn't want it to happen. We wouldn't want it to happen. But if it does, then we need to manage that and brace for the impact as much as possible, which I think is a sensible approach. So I certainly remain as much as possible, although hope is not a strategy. I also remain very hopeful that we can avoid that from happening. But if it has happened, it's going to impact on our economy, most certainly. And that is not going to be good for anybody. So that's obviously my concern, but we may well avoid it. But should we not, then we must make sure we are as ready as we possibly can be for that eventuality. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thanks, Dr. George. I think we have exhausted item 5, responses from National Treasurer and FIC. Are there announcements?
No announcements, except that our next meeting will be next week, Tuesday.
Okay.
We have nothing for the rest of this week.
Okay. Comrade Momo and Nokwanda, can you please remain in the platform when others will be leaving? Thanks very much, colleagues. And stakeholders who are in the platform, the media. We have come to an end of our meeting. Thanks, National Treasurer and FIC. Let's adjourn our meeting. We'll take the process to the next stage of the committee, processing the report, and then take it to the National Assembly. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Chair.
There's no Kwanda still here.
Yes, I'm still here.
Thank you, Chair.
About the what was so. Noxy.
Yes, I'm still here, Chair. Oh, not me. Oh, sorry.
Okay.
Noxy.
Hi, Chair.
America, where are you going?
I'm in Canada for the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association Conference.
Oh, yeah. You're very far.
Shame. Yeah, my granddaughter said so yesterday. She said, "Are you still far?" And I'm like, "Yes, darling." And she says, okay, I tell her that it took me like 24 hours to come here. And then, Kulu, did the pilot not fall asleep?
And what's the time for you? You must be at 3 o'clock or
yes, Mom. Eish, I was going to apologize about that as well, because when the meeting starts, it's 3 a.m. here, and I'm like, I'm fiddling. And then apparently I also touched the video opens while I'm in bed. It's so scandalous. But the church called me quickly, and then Beauty also assisted to switch it off. Eish. No, it's too early.
Colleagues, you can log out of the meeting. We just want to have a short caucus with the acting DG and Nokwanda and Comrade Noxy until we meet again next week.